I want to say first, thanks so much for all your help. And it was just such a delight visiting you earlier this year and everything. We've been doing these sort of short, just, you know, casual conversations with curators and collaborators and people that worked with Ashram on these particular projects to build a little bit more of like a social interpersonal context. And of course, your work on the Mole project is so essential to its existence and kind of fundamental. And maybe you could just sort of tell it a bit, like how the show came to be, how you came to be involved, how Michael Asher came to be involved, and just sort of, I don't know, give us a bit of an overview.
Well, in fact, I was invited by the Elder Man of Culture from the city of Mol, which is a small city at the border with Holland. In fact, I had a project for recreating a cultural center in an old building of a manufacture, it was called Manufacture de Couverture de Laine, which translates like a manufacturer of linen blankets. So it was like empty for like 20 years, and they wanted to transform it into a cultural center. And they asked me, I don't know why, but they asked me in fact to do an exhibition in these rooms before it was transformed. I said, well, fine. I was teaching mathematics at a grammar school. So this was a very interesting surprise. And I met with this alderman. It was fantastic, in fact. He said, you know, if you want to do a proposal, and we will see what we can do. So I made a choice of 8 artists. First, I saw the premises because I hadn't seen it before. Not the outside, yes, but not the inside. So it was an abandoned factory, actually. And it was poorly maintained. And just there were a few rooms, in fact, that had served as the administration of the building that were still more or less intact. So I proposed, in fact, the list of the 8 artists. And, they had no idea who these people were. Anyway, this elderman, he was a funny guy, in fact. He was really great. He said, you can do what you want, in fact, but you have to pay for it. You have to find the money because you don't have any money and you have to organize it. I said, okay, fine with me. I didn't know what I was saying because I had never done that before. I had never worked in a museum, never worked with artists and all that. I knew many artists, but I was never involved in this kind of organizational situation. So I started to contact the artists and they all agreed. Within a lapse of time of like 3-4 weeks. And so for the Americans, in case, of course, Michael Asher and John Knight, I sent them photographs. And this was also a time when Kaspar Koenig was preparing the Münster exhibition, Skulpturprojekt in Münster, which was the second time he did it, in fact, after 1977. This was 1987. It was 1987, yeah. When he did his second version. And so I was in contact with him because he was also showing Michael. And I thought maybe we can find an agreement for the costs of it, because it is very practical. I contacted Kasper and he said, you're fine, that's great. And maybe you can share costs, in fact, for the air travel, because I didn't have any money either. I didn't have anything. So I started to write, in fact, to all kinds of cultural instances if they wouldn't support the exhibition. So I had meetings with people in the ministry, and one of the eldermen from the same city of Mol was a friend of Louis de Bie, who was the elderman of culture, and he was responsible for everything that was had to do with business. He didn't like, in fact, the art I was showing him. He said, you know, this is crazy stuff. This is not something, but, you know, I like you, so I'm going to support you. And so he introduced me in all these smaller and bigger factories and companies in Mol and in the environment. And they had like, I don't know, 15, 20, 25, 30 contacts. And they all agreed, in fact, to put money in the exhibition. This might sound very down to earth, but this is, of course, something. The art was okay for me. I knew the art. I'd seen all the artists. I'd seen all the exhibition. I lived like 20 kilometers of, Eindhoven, where you could see the most avant-garde exhibitions you can imagine. And so I did some presentations of it in like service clubs and all that, and they all agreed to pay, and they did. And so I started doing it, in fact. And so Michael came the first time when he came back from Munster, and I had to pick him up in Dusseldorf. But I'd never seen him before, but that was no problem. I had to have the train station, and I knew exactly who it was, in fact, but in the crowd. And so we got on immediately very well. I'm going to, maybe I should restrict, in fact, everything to my experience with Michael, because that's, of course, the subject of this phone call. He stayed at our home, in fact, for like a few days. And so we discussed about the building and about the project. And if he agreed, in fact, to collaborate and to make a proposal, and it happened. So he was fine. He was fine with it, and that's how it started, from scratch. You can say this was a project from scratch, and so I had to find out everything myself. I had no help except for my wife, who helped me, in fact, with all kinds of administrative details, and I couldn't even type without a computer, sorry. Anyways, that's how it started, and started slowly. I got a proposal from Michael. It was quite easy, in fact, that clear what he wanted to do, and it involved the facade of the building. There was, of course, the architect who was responsible for the new building, for the renovation, in fact, of this factory plant, and who was going to renovate it. But when we, and then of course, I should tell you this, at a certain point, I don't know exactly the date and the hours and all that, but I know that Michael and John were in Mol, and we had an appointment with the architect, and he showed us the plans of this new cultural center. It was awful. Yeah, he was going to hide everything that was the factory. There was nothing left from the original building, except for just the basic structure, but it was all covered up with ceramic tiles. So it was terrible, in fact. So we decided to go on for this, and we told the alderman that we couldn't agree with the renovation plans. And then, of course, Michael did a proposal that concerned the building itself and what it was before, and John did something about the renovation itself. The other artist did a very traditional way of being involved with an exhibition, let's put it this way. So they submitted a proposal. One was going to reconstruct his studio in one of the rooms of the building. The building was a factory building, so there was huge and large rooms. So he reconstructed his studio from Amsterdam in this building. He did a wall painting inside the studio, which was an exact copy, in fact, of the inside of his studio. There was another one who was painting some kind of a strip around the windows of one room. There was another one who installed a new painting. He did an installation with a new painting, which was like something like 10 meters on 2 meters. There was another one who did an installation inside one of the rooms. It's difficult when you describe it, but it was using prefabricated stones and all that. So it was a very diversity of interactions. But Michael's was, it concerned the building itself directly. He asked me, in fact, there was a strip across the facade, in fact, of the building. It was something like 50 centimeters on 30 or something, 25, 20 meters. And he asked me, in fact, to check out if there was something that was written on this large, it was a band, yeah? And it indeed it was. In fact, what I discovered was that the original name of the factory, and Manufacture de Couverture Lin, that it was written across this band. And there had also been a plaque at the entrance with the name of the factory, but it was gone. It disappeared, and I didn't find it back, in fact. But the holes of the fixtures, in fact, were still there. I put on a scaffold against the facade, and I started to scratch on the paint that was on the band, and I discovered the original lettering. So I reconstructed the whole text that was on the band, and including the colors it was painted in. So I sent him the details, and so he asked me if I could find the colors back. So I sent him the exact colors using this Pantone matching system. So he asked me if I could to put the name of the exhibition, Intensely Irrational Form, instead of the original lettering. And that's what I did. It's easy to say now, but if you're alone and you're like 3 meters above the, 4 meters almost above the ground, and trying to scratch, in fact, the original lettering and to reconstruct it. So I sent him all the details, and anyway, so that's how it was done. And the same goes for the plaque, yeah, for the name of the organization, which was called Free Society of the Visual Arts and Vrije Genootschap voor de Beeldende Kunst. So he sent me back a letter. Everything was by letter, or from time to time by phone, but it was so expensive at the time that it was something we prepared to, we tried, in fact, to avoid. But as you know, Michael, you can be like for an hour, 2 hours on the telephone. Anyway, so we reconstructed the text on the strip across the building, and we had the plaque made by a local firm, and so we put it up. And anyway, that's briefly, in fact, the gist of the idea.
Fred, thank you so much for kind of recounting it from the beginning of this formation of the cultural institution to then your involvement. And, you know, you mentioned this. I found it fascinating to know actually who painted the facade, because there was a bit of a process to this, how it came to be that the lettering was actually painted on the building, right? Because I think you told me originally someone was brought in to do it.
Yeah. So I thought maybe there was someone when I was working there, all alone, in fact, yeah. And from time to time, there was someone from the town, from the city, in fact, who came to see how far we were, in fact, in installing it, and if we needed something and all that. So I said, yeah, is there someone who could do the lettering? So they sent me someone who was a student from the academy, and they started to reconstruct, in fact. I should say that I had made the whole band on a one-to-one format in paper. So it was a roll, in fact, of paper that had a whole text, in fact. So the only thing they had to do, in fact, was to redraw it on the wall and then paint it. After 3 days, it took a lot of time, in fact, to convince this person how to do it, and they had no clue how to approach the problem. So finally, I said, you know, thank you very much. This was very nice meeting you, and you're trying to help me, but I'm going to do it myself. So I did it myself. I drew everything on the wall, then I painted it. It took me quite a long time. Like, I don't remember how long, in fact, because it was. We couldn't work when it was raining, and still. But I was whole alone. I was alone in doing this. But I didn't. I thought it was normal. Yeah. So I had no experience. I had no crew, in fact, to install it. Ultimately, in fact, it worked out. We got the whole. There's a postcard. It doesn't show the colors, but it shows fairly well, in fact, what was done on this strip with the text. And when Michael came, he had never seen it. I had sent him some photographs while he was working, but he had never seen it before. And so when he came to Mole to check, in fact, on the advancement of the work, it was finished, in fact. And so we turned the corner and he saw it. And he said, oh, I've never heard him say one French word, but that was the first time and the only time, in fact. Isn't it? Holy shit. But he couldn't believe it. We did it ourselves, but it was normal. I mean, that's how you do it. That's how I thought you do it. And certainly when you don't have a staff that can solve the problems, so you needed to solve all the problems ourselves. It was a huge experience for me in any way also.
So as we understand it, there's three major elements to the project: the painted sign on the facade, the brass plaque, and then a really integral part of the project is actually this souvenir postcard that you and him produced.
Yeah, yeah. So at a certain point, the facade was finished, And then I took a few photographs. I do believe I sent him in like three different angles. And so he chose one, and we had a postcard production firm. It was a printer, in fact, who produced it. It was rather banal, simple to do, in fact. It just took time. And so when the postcards were produced, in fact, we went to all the different shops in Mall that sold postcards of the city. And this was placed between all the other ones. There's a photograph in the catalogue that shows one of these postcard stamps, and you can see, in fact, the photo, the postcard among all the other ones.
I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit about just the postcard is really interesting because he repeats this with the garbage trucks, obviously, and then also just using these shops as a venue for distribution. So maybe you could just talk about tourism and distributing this postcard as a good in relation to this project and future ones.
For me, it was quite obvious what he was doing. I knew his work quite well, in detail even. And so to have the three elements, in fact, was exactly what concerned the building. There was no intricate theoretical background to legitimize, in fact, these different, and this was a work of art. And it was consisted of four elements, in fact. It was the building, of course. It was the postcard, the band, and the plaque. You know, and that's it. Within the context of the false renovation of the architect, it was clear that once the band was painted, they had to destroy a work of art, and the memory of the work of art, namely the postcard, which was some kind of contained the memory, the mnemosyne, the memory of the work, even if it was destroyed. If they had to do the renovation, they had to destroy a work of art. Although the exhibition was in a limited time, from September to November, and it was inscribed, in fact, in the project, like Michael always did. What we did, in fact, was tearing down the different elements and sent them because they were objects. I didn't want to keep an object that had been part of an exhibit. It belonged to the artist, so we sent it back to the artist. We couldn't send the band back because it was on the wall, and the postcards same. But I don't know exactly what you wanted to say, in fact, with what intrigued you about the postcards.
Just that he's used that form in the past, and I guess the simplicity of it is interesting, memorializing the artwork and then distributing it in a public realm.
Yeah.
But what you said was great.
Which was it was quite obvious for me, because in principle, once the exhibition was over, the work was over. So how to keep a trace in the future of what happened, in fact, in Mall, something should be there that was worth keeping it and what was worth documenting it. So the postcard had two functions. It was, in the first way, the representation of one of the city highlights, like it had all the other things, like the church and all this kind of stuff, which were also on postcards. So it had the same function. It was a commemorative object that people who came to Mall could buy and take home. Although they had no idea what they were taking home. I didn't know how to solve as a problem, meaning that this was art that most people in the city of Mol had no idea that it existed. Frankly, I didn't care myself. I wanted just to do this exhibition. I wanted to show work, and you don't know your public. You don't know them personally. So you do something, and some people will pick it up and take it home in one way or the other in their mind. It can still be sold, in fact.
Yeah, and it makes me want to ask a question because, like as you said, which is really interesting about cultural memory and material memory, which the postcard and this artwork really address. And then, of course, that is expressed in the work and its own ending, but also in the way Asher rewinds the building to this iconography, the font, the signage of this Louis Van Dorn textile factory. And I'm curious, maybe information like the font, the color, the name, the what it manufactured. He's creating a kind of hinge that addresses past, present, and future kind of in one set of gestures.
Yeah. The postcard was the whole work. It contained information about the whole work. It showed the facade, it showed the lettering, the text, the title of the exhibition. That means the situation in which this particular facade and the lettering and the text that was on the lettering, what it meant and all that. It's all in this postcard because it was in, you can see the facade, you can see the text, you can see the plaque, and you have the postcard in your hand if you're looking at it. You see, it was a great idea of using the postcard not only as a commemorative object, but also as a documentation of the whole work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it doesn't neutralize the idea of documentation as just a photographic reproduction, but it actually puts it into play. I mean, maybe that's what Stella's also a bit asking, is like,
physical remnant. It's not documentation. It's a physical remnant. It's something that continues on. You see?
Yes. Absolutely. And did you, in your research, did you learn much about this textile factory, like what it manufactured and also how they came to use that layering style and a bit of their own aesthetics?
We turned every document upside down, backward, forwards. There was very little that was also very interesting, in fact, that there was very little information about this factory. There were dates, in fact, when it was installed, in like early 1900s, how it went on, how it was suffered from the wars, that they had to close it down. And then it went more or less broke, that there was someone else who took it over. But in itself, how it worked inside, the photographs from the inside of the building were virtually non-existent. We've got one or two photographs in the catalog. But that's more or less it. There was little information about the actual workings. And of course, I didn't do any research on that, except for what I could find. There was a small collections of the city that were exhibited in some kind of a cultural center, not really a cultural center, a building that contained information about the city and about how it was before and all that. But they didn't have any information. There was very little information available at the time, except that it had been for the city itself quite a big factory. But the memory was faded away in over time, and people who were would work there, they were all dead, because the original building where it was built for hadn't functioned like even in 1987, like for 30 years, 40 years, so there was no one left, in fact.
And this, I mean, one of the other resonances of this project is definitely and it's something that comes up again in Asher's work, is study of the adaptation of historic industrial buildings. You know, it's something that he obviously is very interested in and applies methods to. And he does the project in Villeurbanne, the melting down of the cast iron furnaces. And so maybe, did you have a sense a bit of his interest in this, looking at how industrial manufacturing buildings were becoming cultural institutions?
Yeah, well, of course he was interested in this cultural institution, it would be the cultural center. He was interested in how in the first place, because there was no cultural center at the time, it should be constructed through the renovation of this building. The real reason to use the facade, to reuse the plaque, to use the postcard, to show how it should be remembered in the new cultural center, how it should be given a new meaning without imposing how to do it, and how it's just like, this is what you have. If you want to make it a cultural center, you have to keep the memory of the work that has been done, of the importance of the building in the city. The only way to do it, in fact, was to keep the building the way it was. This was the only remnant of the cultural center, of the original meaning of the building.
And can I ask then, maybe unlike many of Asher's projects, famously his work makes an intervention or makes a set of interventions which then have a temporal life, and then they go away. And this one, more than many, actually, as you'd mentioned to me before, kind of help. It did actually have an afterlife, or did participate in an afterlife that was very different in terms of the actual institution itself.
It has a physical afterlife, yeah, through the postcards. It's a physical afterlife. Still now, I mean, I still have a stack of postcards. It can continue forever. In fact, like usual works of art are. They never have an indefinite life. But like you said, and like it was Stella, I think it was Stella, that she was interested in the postcards. The postcard was was actually the smallest object in the exhibition with the longest memory. He was doing a work of art. He was doing a visual work of art. It was aesthetic, yeah. And everything else was temporary. But the fact that the work survives means that it was a statement. The way he conceived it, in fact, was a statement against the abuse of cultural representational aspects of his work, the subject, with a difficult word, appropriation, in fact, of the past to a building, and this was bizarre.
As we've read a bit, and then you know you've said it in your catalog essay too, the cultural institution then did not go as planned. The thing that would have happened, happened.
The interventions of Michael and John had a consequence because I told the Alderman of Culture, it's a very complicated story. It's a very complicated story because it didn't only involve an exhibition and a statement of artists through their work of what was happening in this context of the Van Doorn factory. It had consequences for the politics in this city. You have no idea how people tried to, who some people from this council of aldermen, who were against it, tried to sabotage it. I don't think it's interesting to tell because it's trivial. And I was aloof of the world, so I didn't even grasp it in the beginning. It took me a few months before I realized that there were people trying to sabotage it. And so, if you don't know anything, this is the best way to continue working without to want to. I had no idea. I couldn't imagine that people were against it, and so they tried to. It went very far because at a certain point, there were workmen from the city, worked for the city, who were sent by the Alderman of Culture to help me in installing stuff. And I learned by accident, in fact, that they've been instructed to slow down everything as much as possible. Yeah, can you imagine? And I had no clue. It was like going so. And so when I learned about it, I told the Alderman of Culture and I said, you know, I do believe there's something happening. Yeah, I know that they don't want the exhibition to succeed, and they don't want the intervention of the artists, and they want to have the cultural center built like the architect planned it. So, at a certain point, the architect sent us money. Yeah, so we sent it back. We needed the money, but we sent it back. And there were a few artists I knew, in fact, in Molland, who said, you know, so I told them that we sent it back. And so they assembled the money and they paid us the money that was normally sent as sponsoring by the architect. Another one was, I was introduced, there was one of the local entrepreneur. He was president of the Society of People, of directors of FAF, of fabrics, and of who had more than 100 people. And so I was invited to them, so they wanted to offer me money. One of them was the director of a factory of dynamite. So he said, you know, give me your number and I send you money and all that. So of course I never gave him my number nor the account. And there are crazy stories about this and it's a wonder that it succeeded. But I had never, everything negative came as it was too late for the negative to succeed. Before I grasped it, I just continued doing it. And I do believe that Michael took great pains in not being someone from thousands of miles away to intervene in the proceedings of a city and in the real proceedings of a city. Yeah? And there was nothing alien to the culture of that city, nothing that was referring to theory or, well, something of a proposal for doing it otherwise and all that. It was just an opinion. If it came to the meaning for the city and for the people in the city, it was a proposal of a work of art, and not a proposal for how to do the cultural center. It shows, this was not a museum. There was not people who came in and look at the exhibition and know more or less what Michael's work was about, or not knowing it, but finding something in an institution that was specific for culture, and where the whole context, made them think in this way. This was not the case in the exhibition in Mol. It had nothing to do in the first place with a museum or with the center of contemporary art or whatever. It was a factory that was going to be a cultural center, but a cultural center is something very large. It can include an exhibition room, but also a cafe or rooms for music and all that. So it's a very different situation from the institutions where normally Michael worked. It was not a Van Abbe Museum or not a contemporary art center. And so this was why we shouldn't look too much after art historical references, art historical in terms of contemporary art and where we are at the moment, or at that moment. See what I mean?
No, that makes total sense. That it's really addressing context, but the context itself is different than many other spaces he worked in at that time.
And everything else. I mean, I don't know any, so top of my head, I don't know of any other works that are in a very different center, in a very different context than an art context. He was working in museums. He was invited by contemporary art centers, everything where the context of the presentation of the work is not already art. You see?
No, totally. No, you're like splitting a hair, but it's actually a really big hair. No, absolutely. Can I ask that, Fred, then, maybe you said as much, but then we come to understand that the renovation never happened, the cultural institution never opened.
Yeah, the cultural center was never built. The plans were put aside. In one way or the other, it seemed to have worked with many people in the city who thought that the cultural center was megalomania. Yeah, but most of the people in the Council of Aldermen didn't care about it. They wanted this kind of megalomania. But then other cultural institutes, people who wrote from magazines and all that, I read an article 5 years afterwards that they were very happy that it didn't succeed and that they were now waiting what was going to happen with the building. Yeah, ultimately the building is still there, more or less the way it was before. It has an exhibition room somewhere, but it also functions for the youth, for youths and for all kinds of other different, not really artistic purposes. But the building, the plans of the architect and of of the city were never realized. So actually, this was a very political work of art. Yeah, the one made by John. John was very straightforward. Yeah, you've seen the work of John. Huh?
We've seen it in your catalog. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. Anyway, so it was there were direct important political consequences of these installations. Yeah. Although it was never meant to be, how should I say? I don't think Michael meant to intervene in the politics of the city. That was not his role. He can just maybe throw his attention to something that was not really very good, in fact, for the city. But it had consequences. Yeah. Fascinating, isn't it?
It's so fascinating. And can I ask one more curatorial question? Can you say a bit about the title, the Intenti un Rational Vorm, as your exhibition title?
Oh, yeah. It's difficult to summarize, in fact, what I meant with the title. It was rather straightforward. It meant the title was very bad if I have to explain it, but it meant that the work of art, the intention of the work of art, is realized by reason, and that this reason, that there is a relationship between form and intent. So something static, like form, and intention, something that's very dynamic. You know? And otherwise, I have to go into a theoretical discussion, which I do believe is not really necessary. In fact, there's nothing more to it than that. Yeah. In fact, I was doing my PhD at the time when I was doing the exhibition, and I had been in theory like for years, and I was so fed up with theory that I didn't want to address it. I just wanted to be practical. You see what I mean? You lose contact with the rest of the world because it's scholastic, you know? At a certain point, I myself was talking in a way that there was no more solid ground. Once you start theorizing, one word follows from another one, and I can start with Kant and Hegel, going through Adorno, yeah, and we end up somewhere. After Adorno, there's little left to theorize, in fact, but still, it's something that comes after the work of art. I always told my students, you know, we're sitting here, and we're always 20 years behind. Philosophy, art theory, is always 20 years behind, because there needs to be something before you can have theory. And you see what I mean? I wrote a thesis of 450 pages on this kind of stuff. So afterwards I put it in the cupboard and say, okay, fine, that's it. And that's not concerned with real art. And I'm not against it. Don't understand me wrong. In fact, I do believe it's very important to do. But at a certain point, you lose contact with where it started from. One word follows another, and another one. I've got, for the moment, for instance, this has nothing to do, of course, with Michael, but I was a promoter of a PhD on Marcel Broodhoff, and I warned the student, watch out, because you can end up with a lot of words and no content, although it seems to be content. And he's still contacting me every time he writes a text. He sent a text. They say, you know, what do you think about it? Isn't it, I'm not like fading into nothingness. Is this sound too negative? Maybe it should. Maybe it should.
No. Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. No, and Fred, this is an amazing conversation. Stella, did you have any other questions?
No, I was just going to, I thought you said it was really interesting that Michael's project was an aesthetic one, was very visual. And also that you said the postcard was kind of a confusing object because it's obviously commemorating something that's happening in the present, his project, even though it's nodding back to the past. And I guess I was wondering if you had a sense of people's perception of the like kind of anachronism of the sign, like its actual design, people who encountered it, or if that wasn't.
Yeah, I know what you mean with an anachronism, but I don't think it is. It's not because you reuse a typeface that it is an anachronism. We're living in a time where you don't have anything but anachronisms because everyone is reusing stuff from the past, new typefaces. In fact, our old typeface is a little bit changed and all that. So I don't think so. It was a very physical exhibition. I mean, not only for Michael's work, but also in the case of Michael, it's not. There's also a plaque, you know. No, and it's indestructible, almost. Yeah. So it's for me. It was quite interesting, in fact, to see how he made decisions or to guess how he made decisions, because I not always grasped it in the beginning what he was wanted to do. It's a very exceptional work, and it has never been discussed, and as far as I know, outside of the mole presentation, but maybe it should. It shouldn't be done by me because I was too much involved, in fact, and it should be done by the information that exists so that It's within the context of his whole work, it's quite exceptional. I'm pretty sure about this. It has a lot of consequences for the interpretation of his work. If it wasn't for the out-of-art context of the presentation, maybe the water in the water fountain in...
Yeah.
In Los Angeles,
mm-hmm.
which was also something that was outside and was not really, but it wasn't, I don't know. This is one of the few examples I know. And I haven't checked, so there may be others, but what I didn't pay attention to, quite exceptional. It really had consequences. I don't know whether Michael was in favor of his work having this kind of consequences. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And yeah, we felt, I mean, you know, I think for Stella and me working on this show, it's projects like this one that are actually complete epiphanies and discoveries to us that's like the most exciting, you know, because, yeah, I would agree with what you're saying, that when you really think and study what this was and what this set of like historical and iconographic enactments, you know, in these ways, it's such a consequential work, you know, majorly consequential work, but kind of completely hidden.
I was just going to ask if you thought that Michael was aware of how consequential this work was in particular at the time that it happened.
I don't, it's very dangerous for me to say, to answer this question, but I don't think he was being a politician. He was not. I never felt that he was trying to act as a politician in this context. He was just doing a work of art, and it may have had consequences, but he never. I don't think so. No, he was not. He was not. Not. We've seen what happened when politicians do bizarre things. He was not a politician. He was an artist, and he was aware of the fact that everything we do is political. What you do is political, what I do is political, or can be used by politicians, which is a very different kind of perception. No, I don't believe he was counting on transformation of the minds of the people from Mol. You see what I mean? Just drawing attention to something and people can think for themselves. At least it's what I hope, that people can think for themselves. You see?
Yeah. Stella, do you feel like you all your questions are answered. I feel like mine are, actually.
Yeah, that was so, it was great. It was really, really great.
Yeah, Fred, we can't thank you enough.
I still feel lost. I didn't prepare anything because the only thing I did was went back to my documents, which I found back when you were. It's very emotional for me, I can tell you.
Yeah.
Bring back bizarre, fantastic, incredible memories.
Yeah.
It's
also so, I mean, you know, you told me this when we were together. This was your one exhibition in your life where you worked with living artists, right? I mean, it's not your work typical to work with artists making new work like this. It was one.
I don't know where I told you, but in the same city there was a grammar school, and I was teaching descriptive geometry and mathematics. I had two different diplomas, but of course, as an art historian, it's very difficult to find work. So I found work because I also have this older diploma. I taught math, and which is bizarre. It's easy. Math is easy. It doesn't have any consequences, but it doesn't represent anything. But that's why it was so easy to flip from one interest into another one. No, I had never done an exhibition before. I was more or less educated in art through the Van Abbe Museum. And so I saw all these avant-garde artists from the... my sister was working for Philips radios and stuff and all that. And so in Eindhoven. And so she took me to the Van Abbe Museum when I was like 15. And I saw the first exhibition of Jupp in 1970. And it didn't even impress me. I was so used to bizarre stuff that I thought was quite interesting that someone could put wooden boxes in a museum. And it was like, it was rock, like rock music. And of course, afterwards, the more you know, the more it changes your perception. But this was my background, you know? They showed everyone. They showed Lothar Baumgarten, Don Olcott, Flanagan, Robert Ryman, Richard Long, all these people, Requiem, Ian Wilson. So that was my background. And there was the exhibition in 1977 from Michael, which I saw, but I didn't even see it in the beginning. I hadn't seen it in the beginning. I didn't know what he did. Yeah? But I was like, I had no idea. And it was only afterwards that I picked it up when the Book of Buchlo came out, yeah, with the seven European works. That was an eye-opener. So I was in Documenta 72. I haven't even seen Michael's work. There's nothing simple in the way people come to it. Yeah, it's trial and error. I haven't done anything. I had seen all these exhibitions, and I had many times. The Van Abbe Museum was very important for me, anyway, and Fuchs, and it was quite a special occasion to get acquainted with art. You have to remember that this is the countryside, isn't it? The biggest city is in Belgium is Brussels. It has 1 million inhabitants, which is nothing. There's no big cultural art center in the neighborhood. You know?
Right.
So the Van Abbe Museum was a small museum, but it had the opportunity to show all these conceptual artists on a small scale, but very early.
It's clearly such a beacon for Europe. Yeah. Fred, we really can't thank you enough.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay. Bye.
Bye.